Hey, Bruiser Buddies, this is Wrestling Nostalgia with Dave Dynasty.
Before we dive into the episode, make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast platform you're listening on. Also, follow me on X at The Dave Dynasty and subscribe on YouTube by looking up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty. You can also buy one of my shirts at ProWrestlingTees.com/TheDaveDynasty. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser said it all.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brains to get past the excellence of execution?
The reason why X and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine isn't government issue.
Yellow, everybody. Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I am your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining me. Once again, I'd like to apologize for there not being a new episode last week. I hate missing weeks. Drives me nuts. But I had several interviews scheduled, several going on, and different things on my side, on some guest side. Just scheduling got to be chaotic and a mess, and nothing ended up panning through. So, alas, no episode. I apologize. But, man, I have a good one for you today, a little bit longer than usual even. Totally interesting, and not only one guest, but I'm bringing you three guests on this episode. It's a group Portland wrestling discussion. Joining me is Mike Rogers, Kirby Strome, and Rich Patterson. I introduce all of them in the beginning of the interview, tell you all their credentials, etc. But this is a great chat, talking all about things Portland Wrestling. So let's take a break and get right to it. You know me, no fluff, just get to it. Let's have that conversation. So when we come back, we're going to talk Portland Wrestling.
Hey, you bums, we have to take a quick break.
Filsinger Games is a tabletop cards and dice game company that has enjoyed success for over three decades. Their first game was Champions of the Galaxy and was released in 1986. Champions of the Galaxy is a tabletop game that features professional wrestling over 100 years in the future. Humans, aliens, and monsters battle in the Galactic Wrestling Federation for belts. Legends of Wrestling features officially licensed wrestling cards featuring stars like Ted DiBiase, Jimmy Snuka, Harley Race, and many, many more, including game sets for independent promotions. Each match takes place in real time. The action is fast and furious, and all the things that happen in pro wrestling, like cage matches, outside interference, three-man tag matches, they also happen in the games. You have the opportunity to run your own wrestling promotion involving either real-life stars or fictional characters of the future, or you can mix and match both. Visit FilsingerGames.com for more information and to order the games today. That is Filsinger Games, FilsingerGames.com to order now. If you like horror movies, be sure to check out Dave Dynasty and Ike Isaacs on the Listen to Their Screams Horror podcast. It is available on all podcast platforms and on social media at Listen to Screams. That is Listen, the number two, and Screams. Hey ho, everybody. Subscribe to the Pinhead Pod, the Ramones fan podcast, bringing you interviews, news, deep dives, and much more. Look it up on your favorite podcast platform. That is Pinhead Pod.
We're back on Wrestling Nostalgia.
All right, and welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. This time I'm ready to start the Portland Wrestling discussion, and here we go with all the introductions. First, we have Mike Rogers, author of Katie Bar the Door, The History of Portland Wrestling, The Encyclopedia of Portland Wrestlers from the House of Action, and Excitement in the Air, the Voices of Northwest Wrestling, Volumes 1 and 2. Hello, Mike.
Hi.
And then we have Kirby Strome, a collector of Portland Wrestling memorabilia, curator of the Instagram account Classic Portland Wrestling, where he shows off his collection, and a member of the band, is it Danava?
Donava. Sorry.
I tried.
Sorry.
How you doing, Kirby?
I'm doing all right. Thank you.
Usually I don't have any competition for most hair. And
I just gave it a trim, too, so this is kind of short for me right now.
All right. Well, I haven't trimmed mine, so. All right. And then finally, we have Rich Patterson, who's also an avid collector of Portland Wrestling memorabilia and a savior of many Portland Wrestling VHS, as well as the network producer for the NBA's Portland Trailblazers radio broadcast, who we might mention. Rich just passed his 3,000th consecutive game milestone. Congratulations, Rich.
Thank you very much. Great to be here with you guys talking Portland wrestling.
That's right. Now, in an effort to keep this where we don't go for 24 hours, we're going to do an overview of Portland wrestling. Now, we'll dive deep. Now, we may revisit in the future, one or more of you, to go deeper. But we're going to keep this kind of broad scope for maybe those who aren't as familiar with Portland. So let's start by each of you kind of giving me kind of your first memories of Portland wrestling. Mike, let's start with you.
Okay. Probably when I was about six, seven years old, it came on television. My grandparents liked Portland wrestling. My mom liked Portland wrestling. And I was just absolutely fascinated and captivated by what was on TV. And when I was 8 years old, I discovered that the results were in the newspaper, and I started clipping those out. There was a short time where I left the Northwest when I was 8, 9 years old. I had my grandma save the newspapers, the sports sections, so when I did come back, I would know what had happened while I was gone. Just complete and total fascination with the whole concept.
Now, what time period was that, Mike, when you discovered?
I was born in 1960, so we're talking about 1968, 1969. That's my first memory.
Okay. Now, in that time period, was there any kind of Portland sports scene to speak of besides the wrestling?
You mean other sports?
Yeah, other sports. What was happening in Portland at that time? Do you recall?
Rich, the Trailblazers started what, in 71?
Portland and the Trailblazers started in 1970. So the time period Mike's talking about, all we had were the Portland Buckaroos hockey team, which was like, and the Portland Beavers baseball team, which were both like AAA in hockey and baseball.
Okay. So not a whole lot to speak of, right? I mean, now we're not talking any, big franchises yet. So,
right. And the one thing that really is really important about Portland wrestling, it was constant on TV. It was just a tradition. That's the best word. And I don't know if the other territories, every territory had wrestling, but in Portland, it was just such a tradition. I bet. You could compare it to Memphis, just such a tradition that even non-wrestling fans knew about Portland wrestling. They knew the top wrestlers that were involved. They might not follow the storylines or even watch, but everybody knew who Lonnie Main was, and everybody knew who Tony Bourne was back in those days.
Yeah. All right. What about you, Kirby? When what's your first memory of Portland wrestling?
Well, my education came through Rich's tapes. So I was really enamored, and generally kind of when I delve really into something like this, I tend to go about as far back as I can. So those early Buddy Rose tapes, the 70, I guess you would say the 77 through the 80 period, that's like kind of when Buddy's really hitting his stride, you know, Wiskowski's finally in the territory. You start to see Piper come in and Killer Brooks. And the evolution of, I guess, that feud as it happened, where they were, you know, aligned, and then the I guess the snafu with a tag match where Brooks is kind of compromised, and then all of a sudden it causes the turn of Piper and Brooks and stuff. So yeah, that was like my education really on territorial wrestling. And so yeah, watching a lot of that. Outside of that, you know, my dad grew up in Eugene, having moved from Southern California, and when I was watching wrestling in the 90s, you know, Piper being a favorite of a lot of us, and my dad telling us, oh yeah, you know, he spent a lot of time here in Portland, and he was kind of an established name. And so, you know, when I was able to find this footage and kind of start to see some of this material out there, that's really what began my interest in wanting to learn about Portland wrestling. And then that's just so like grassroots and such like a localized thing that it was something I was interested in. I thought it was just really cool, you know, and that flavor of that is certainly, you know, you don't really see that a lot in the modern presentation of wrestling. Like Portland wrestling, I would say too, like the tapings they would do at the sports arena, that was kind of like the big show. I know they would do Seattle and that would be kind of the other one, but the big show really seemed like it was the Portland Sports Arena, and that environment that created and fostered, I think, was just really, really cool. So yeah.
And you mentioned Eugene, right? One of the major spot show towns.
The Eugene, I guess they called it the Cow Palace there. I don't know that it was referred to the Cow Palace outside of wrestling. I don't know if you guys can speak to that, but that was one thing I kind of discovered recently. It was, I guess it's just essentially the Eugene Fairgrounds, but the building there they would call the Cow Palace. So I don't know if they were just trying to spruce it up a bit or whatever, but
yeah. And obviously, you know, Kirby, like we mentioned, right, you're heavily involved in the music scene.
Yeah.
You mentioned that appeal of that localized, right? That kind of a parallel to the music, right? Every, you know, these major towns had their scene, right? Their flavor, their bands. Did you feel that parallel? Did that appeal to you?
Is there a parallel
there between music and wrestling for you with that?
Definitely. And I would say that's probably also kind of a bygone era now that we live in like such a digital world.
Right.
You know, bands would be so regional because they would play the same towns in a lot of cases that these wrestlers would do.
Yep.
And that's how you'd be established. Like, you know, out here we have like the Wailers and the Sonics. So a lot of people have reverence for, and that's just sort of the same thing they were doing. And they were ruled the roost in terms of Northwest music. And then, you know, you can kind of go down the line of generations, but yeah, I mean, I guess I recognized that and I understood that, you know, I was like, yeah, that it's totally by the same playbook, you know?
Yeah. All right. Go ahead, Mike.
I'm sorry. If I can just interject one thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Greg Oliver came to visit to Portland and he and I went over to Kirby's house for an afternoon. We could have stayed there a week. we were just absolutely fascinated and just really gave Kirby a lot of credit because he has so much passion. But the one thing that we went away with was he has so much passion and he never was able to see it live or as, back in that day. And I can only imagine, you know, if he had experienced it like Rich and I did, you know, as just because we're older, but props off to Kirby because his passion is just unbelievable.
I appreciate that, Mike. I always joke that, like, you know, given the time machine scenario, it's always like, what band would you see? And for me, it's always like, oh, I'd have to see some Portland wrestling. I'd have to see Ramos and Savage, you know, match or whatever. Like that's more of the bucket list for me, you know, given the time machine scenario. So I appreciate that, Mike. Thank you.
If you don't mind me asking, Kirby, how old are you?
I'm 37.
Okay. Well, I'm a little older than you, but I'm kind of that same. I was born and raised in Indiana originally.
Yeah.
Right. And I didn't see any live, you know, WWA Bruiser until the 80s. Right. Which was not the best period for WWA, but, you know, close to my heart. And I'm much the same way. Right. If I could go somebody, you know, I want to see WWA in the 70s. Right. That's what I would do. And, but it's kind of that same way that not being there sparked a passion in me. Right. Of wanting to dig, wanting to find, wanting to learn everything I could for what existed before me.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, being so kind of allowing myself to like be immersed in this history. It's sort of like I kind of equate it to maybe if you have an affinity for like old film and stuff, these things kind of start to become your memories because of the amount of time and dedication you go into trying to understand it. And I think that's like why for me in the collecting, like one of my favorite things to get is photos and stuff is to now I can see what it was like. Like, okay, this is, they're wrestling at the Salem Grand Theater, you know, and then you can kind of start to delve into, okay, I think this is 1970 based on, you know, it's Tony Bourne and Lonnie Mane versus the Von Steigers or something. You can then kind of start to deduce where it is. And so, I don't know, it just kind of, allows me to delve into it in a different way, I guess, you know, but yeah.
Well, and you mentioned what Spark kind of helped you get start was Rich and yes. His rescuing of these Buddy Rose tapes, right? Which saved a lot of that Portland footage. Rich, what's some of your first memories of Portland wrestling?
Well, I'm a little younger than Mike. I was born in 1962, and my family, especially my dad and my brothers, both watched Portland wrestling. So I, of course, would watch it with them. An earliest memory, though, for me is in the summer of 1970, I believe. When did was it 1970 or 71 that Johnny Boyd came to town, Mike?
I'm going to say 71.
I think I'm just looking at it. I think it was like June 71 or something.
Yeah.
April, maybe. Yeah.
And this was 4th of July weekend. I remember this because my family was on vacation in Bend and I had to watch Portland wrestling. And it was a black and white TV, but that was no big deal because Portland wrestling was still in black and white. But what I remember was a match between Johnny Boyd and Kurt Von Steiger, I believe, where Boyd won the championship. And so the other Von Steiger comes in, they take Boyd's boomerang and beat the snot out of him. He's a bloody mess from head to toe. He comes up to the Crow's Nest, the interview area in the Portland Sports Arena, and is declaring war on the Von Steigers. And he's going to bring his cousin to town next week. And that was when Norman Frederick Charles III came to town and the Royal Kangaroos were born. So that is one of my earliest memories of watching it on TV. The Kangaroos were also part of the first match I ever went to go see at the Portland Sports Arena. And I know I've told this story many times, so I'm sure Kirby has heard it. We were sitting maybe like five or six rows up, and it was the Kangaroos versus Ed and Bill Francis. And it was bloody. It was a bloody match. And I'm like 8, 9 years old, and I hate seeing this blood. Of course, I still believe everything is on the up and up. And so I'm looking at the ring, but in reality, I'm staring into my brother's shoulder so I don't have to see all the blood. And that was my first trip to the Portland Sports Arena.
Well, and when everybody thinks Portland wrestling, right, the name that immediately pops is Don Owen, right? That's probably what jumps to mind first. But what some people may not know is, you know, Don was, right, his father Herb is what started Portland wrestling, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're talking way back, right? And like, what, 25, something like that? Somebody give me some background on what Herb Owen and what he brought to wrestling. Right? He was also promoted boxing a lot in the day, right? Mike, you've written, yeah, sure, obviously written so many books about, yeah.
So it's my understanding there was a promoter by the name of Ted Thigh, mm-hmm. and he was promoting in Portland. He would also promote half the year in Portland, and then he would go to Australia and promote in Australia as well. And it's my understanding that Herb Owen was working for Thigh, kind of as his assistant or maybe office boy. And when Thigh left, Herb just kind of went into business for himself and took over the promotion. And there was a rule that said only one person, at least in, maybe it was just in each town, could have a license. So Herb, it's my understanding that he got the license in his name and just took over from that point on.
I mean, how pro wrestling is that? Yeah. Like, you're going to leave town and go to Australia. I'm taking the territory.
That's the epitome of Portland, right? That's pro wrestling.
That is wild. And we talk about, right? I mean, Herb, I read that Herb, you know, promoted boxing. I read even supposedly even had Jack Dempsey refereeing some early wrestling matches, right? Lots of crossover things. A few years later, or maybe a couple decades later, right? The NWA is formed, and Portland's tied to the NWA right from the beginning, right? One of the cornerstone territories. Tell us a little bit about that, because Herb play a part in the formation of the NWA?
I am unclear of that. I am not sure. I know that they bought in and they were one of the originals, but I'm not sure how much input he had. It seemed like Elton and Don, even at a young age, became more visible as part of the promotion. Herb, if my recollection is right, was injured in a logging accident. So I don't know how mobile he was, how present he was in front of the fans, and even how in to the degree he was invested in the promotion, other than just getting it started. Yeah. I'm not certain.
Well, if you can find old pictures of the NWA board of directors when they have their board of directors meetings and get-togethers, mm-hmm. you'll always see Don Owen there.
Yeah.
So from an early day, it's and I like to see those pictures because all these guys look the same, and so trying to find Don Owen, picking him out of all these old bald head guys, it's kind of a trick to do that.
You have to find the loud suit jacket. That's always the trademark. But I feel like, too, I want to say that what Ted Thye and Herb Owen kind of were running against each other, too, for a spell as well. Right. And I want to say Matt Farmer one time was mentioning, also another fantastic historian on the Northwest.
Yeah.
I want to say Ted Thye was running kind of more heavyweight style matches, in that the Herb Owen stuff was a little bit more middleweight kind of style guys. I don't know, differentiate. But and I think what Ted Thye is kind of in part involved in the whole NWA lawsuit, or the federal investigation into the antitrust thing too, because I want to say it was his brother was a politician out in like the Midwest, I think in Minneapolis or something. And so he might've had his ear and kind of got involved about, hey, I'm getting pushed out of being able to promote,
Well, and like we said, of course, right, Portland kind of rose to a new level under Don, right, Herb's son. And like Mike mentioned, right, a lot of people don't realize Don had a brother, Elton. And they both, though, got started very early in the promotion, like most promoters' kids do, right? Selling programs, selling popcorn, doing whatever it takes. How did the transition happen? Mike, you mentioned a logging accident. Is that how kind of Don came to kind of take over the promoting and running the business?
I would expect so. Elton, there's results of Elton actually wrestling, certainly boxing, back in the 40s. It wasn't a very long career, just a handful of matches, it looks like. And there was always speculation that Don had one or two wrestling matches as well. But yeah, they just became more prominent, and the faces of wrestling. I think Don probably had a little more business sense. He seemed to be the lead person. Elton primarily, especially in the later years, just took Eugene. Earlier than that, he probably had spot shows. But Elton, the stories go, was kind of a loose cannon. And I think Don was just more of the steady businessman.
And if you talk to wrestlers who worked for both of them, Don was always the nice guy, the good payoff guy. Elton was the asshole.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, very few people have said they didn't like working for Don.
Yeah.
You get a lot more wrestlers who said they didn't like working for Owen.
That Herb Owen, he passed relatively prematurely, I want to say, because I talked to Barry Owen not long ago, and I want to say he either didn't get to meet his grandfather, or he passed when he was very young or something like that. Yeah. So I think that essentially just meant the family business fell into the son's hands,
Yeah, Barry's Don's son, right? Correct?
What? Yes.
One of Don's son, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you don't hear anybody really say across the road about Don Owen, right? Always considered one of the, most honest guys, right? Admirable guy, fair payouts, kept to his word, which might be, why he stayed in business for so damn long, and why people liked working and stayed so loyal to him. I
Yeah.
mean,
And
you
you have
had
guys like
Roddy
him.
Piper.
Yeah. Piper wouldn't work a Portland show when he was with WWF.
That's right. Yeah. And even came, coming back years later to help Don Owen and in different capacities and appearing in different ways, right? Because there was a very strong loyalty, because you always hear that, Don treated everybody fairly. And
The only person I think that really I know has a big gripe was Dean Silverstone, if didn't take to Don. And I know that he was a Harry Elliott guy, so I think he was hoping to get a part of booking the Washington side of things. And so when that didn't happen, he started the whole Superstars promotion or whatever. But in his book, he doesn't have very fond memory. He's one of the few people. And then you hear some of these other wrestlers too that will say it was a Mickey Mouse territory, like your Austin Idols and your Dave Schultz and stuff like that. Because I mean, it was I feel like it was a territory where guys who were shorter in stature were certainly able to work the card and move their way up, Like a guy like Dutch Savage, I think was like 6'2", and he would have been like a big man in the territory,
Well, I mean, some of those guys you mentioned, right? Those are Tennessee guys, right? That's it's different. I mean, it's a different flavor. And
One, I had a chance to interview lots and lots and lots of wrestlers, and one wrestler's story that really stood out to me was Gary Royal. Now, Gary Royal is not a big name in wrestling, but he came into the territory, and through his interview, he said he was promised X amount of money, and that never came to fruition. And he talked about how, for his well-being, he needed to leave the territory, and he did so without giving notice. And he found himself blackballed out of wrestling. And I went to check on that, and I checked through wrestle data to see how much Gary Royal wrestled after leaving Portland. And his claim appears to be fairly accurate because he did not wrestle, but a handful of matches, and most of those were he was under a mask. So he it's a unique story. It's a different story than most everybody else's experience. Gary Royal must not have lived up to Don's expectations because he just, he had some success in Kansas City. When he came here, I had a chance to see Gary Royal in Kansas City. He was a little bit smaller than I expected him to be. And I think that might have hurt his opportunities in Portland. He was very short. But yeah, I find that story fascinating because it isn't the way that most wrestlers found their opportunity in Portland.
One thing about talking about Don Owen and Dr. D, David Schultz, Don had a unique way of mispronouncing wrestlers' names when he's introducing them. Who knows who would be introduced somehow? But the one that I remember so well, and I do have this on one of the tapes, is when he introduces David Schultz as Dr. J.
Dr. J. It almost seems purposeful sometimes, honestly,
I don't think Don Owen was with it enough to make jokes like that. But also now, Mike, you may be able to confirm this. I think it actually may be in one of your books that the reason David Schultz was upset with coming here in the summer of '82 was that he was promised the top spot when Buddy Rose left, because Buddy was supposed to be going to WWF, and Buddy stayed and stayed and stayed, and so Buddy was the established number one heel. There's no one that was going to top him, and so that upset David Schultz. So that's why he left, and he was only here for maybe 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, that was a really interesting time of booking because Schultz and Rose had a long feud, and I had a chance to see one of their matches in Seaside. And the reason why I remember this so well was I knew that Buddy was going to the WWF, And in that match in Seaside, there was a lot of extra filming that was going on. I mean, there was never any filming going on in a spot show in Seaside. And on this night, there was a lot of, they had the exterior lights set up and the white screen and just a lot of filming. And what, 80, 82, I'm 22 years old. And I'm speculating that this must be something for Buddy to go to New York. The booking was interesting because on their final match, which, well, I don't know if it was a loser leave town match, but the match took place and they both left. The booking I liked for Schultz because they had turned him babyface after it was kind of like trying to decide who was going to be the babyface, and fans liked Schultz no nonsense. And he, and my favorite part of his interviews was he would say, I don't want you to jump on my bandwagon, fans, you know, you can go ahead and keep booing me. And they had him start teaming with Brett Sawyer, who was a top baby face. And just the booking was really interesting. It was kind of like, well, let's throw this out there and see how the fans react to it. And so the indecision of exactly where the territory was going at that point, I just thought was really, really interesting.
Yeah, you put anybody in a heel versus heel match with Buddy Rose, and Buddy Rose is going to come out the heel, you know?
Yeah.
In Portland, well, anyway.
Well, and one of the backbones of Portland, right, was the television, right? One of the longest running wrestling television shows of all time. Correct me if I'm wrong. The first televised wrestling in Portland was Owen. Started in 1952, ran all the way up to 1992 with that original run. How integral in the city of Portland was that television show, right? Mike, you mentioned Memphis earlier, right, which was just such a part of the culture. Was it a similar thing in Portland?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the key things was, for a lot, many of those years, the show was live. Mm. And they made an adjustment to where it was tape delayed for about a couple hours, but it was still shown on Saturday nights. It was still the same night that it happened. And I think that really helped the tradition because people all around the state could watch that and know that's what happened earlier in the night. And tradition, you know, we touched on earlier, there just wasn't a lot of other things going on in Oregon, you know, and it really, you know, I can say it was a tradition, but to really make you understand just how big Portland wrestling was, you know, everybody, like I mentioned before, I believe everybody knew about it. They knew what time it was on TV, and they knew some of the wrestlers that were there, even if they weren't fans.
And it was on KPTV, Channel 12 here in Portland, which was an independent station, so they had no network affiliation. And there was many, many years when KPTV had the top two locally produced shows in the country for any independent station. One of those was Ramblin' Rod, which was a kid's cartoon show, and the other was Portland Wrestling.
Yes. So
the ratings for Portland Wrestling in Portland was amazing. And that's why the reason they moved it, Mike, and you probably know this story as well, KPTV got a new general manager in the summer of 1979, and he's obviously watching the show that he is in charge of, or the station he's in charge of. And there's a very bloody match on Portland Wrestling. And he didn't think that was suitable for the 8:30 to 10 o'clock time slot on his station. So that's why they moved it to 11 o'clock tape delayed. But like Mike said, I think that was a genius move because people could go and see themselves on TV. You saw a lot more people going back and forth in front of the ring and waving, having signs and everything, because they could go back and watch themselves.
Yeah. And hey, Kirby, they mentioned you know, right, that you being a little younger, it missed you, but it didn't miss you by much, right? Yeah. I mean, we're talking 92. Did I mean, so we're it almost made it into even to you, right? I mean,
Yeah, well, and the other thing here that's kind of upsetting is my folks knew that me and my brother were very into wrestling, and when Don Owen kind of threw in the towel, Sandy Barr absorbed what
yeah,
was left
correct.
of the promotion. I don't really know the dealing with how that worked out financially or whatever, what the business dealing was with that. But he started up Championship Wrestling USA, and there's like, there was a card they ran, I guess it would have been 94, where there was like Tonya Harding, right? And like Art Barr came back as Love Machine with Eddie Guerrero and stuff. So at the time we're watching wrestling on TV, like meanwhile, my folks could have taken me some of these things, and I'm like, oh man, what a missed opportunity in some of these events that we could have been to. But yeah, what I know they ran the Sandy Barr ran the Portland Sports Arena up there for a spell in 92, and then they kind of started doing a lot of shows at Uncle Milt's Pizza in Vancouver, which was there was another place like this in Portland here called the Organ Grinder, which was like a pizzeria that had these like auto playing organ stuff, just real kind of crazy thing. But that they started running Uncle Milt's Pizza. I feel like that's the and maybe I know Mike covers it in like the Ring Around the Northwest, but I feel like a deep dive on the Championship Wrestling USA promotion would be like really cool. I know there's some footage that exists out there. I don't know if Rich, you have some of that on some of those
I
tapes or
have
whatever.
very, very little.
Yeah, I happened to get lucky and got the sign from that they use at the promotion that they do the promos in front of and that sort of thing. But yeah, I never went to any of those events. That's one that I wish I could have said I had or had the opportunity to, but so it goes.
Well, we several times, right? The Portland Sports Arena has been mentioned, right? And it for those that don't know, right? What it was in 68? Was it 68? Where
Yeah, October
Owen, Don
68.
Owen, right? He bought a bowling alley, right? An old bowling alley, and renovated it, and that was the building, right? For a long time,
Yes.
I mean, Kirby, you have the sign from that? Is that right? Correct?
I have a replica. It's much
It's
more
a
scaled
replica,
down,
okay.
but I have a friend who does a lot of sign painting and stuff, and so I
Yeah.
was able to bribe her with a photo, and she was able
Gotcha.
to just bang it out. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, right? I mean, right in those days, every territory had their buildings, right? That added to the promotion, the flavor, the feel. How integral was the Portland Sports Arena to that feel for Portland wrestling?
I think if you talk to people now who went to the sports arena on many times, including myself, when I think of the Portland Sports Arena, I think of lots of cigarette smoke, the smell of stale popcorn, and I always would drink a stale RC. I mean, there were some things that were just so primitive about it, but I think that's what made it so special is because it was such a unique building. And once again, being a former bowling alley, it had a very strange configuration to it. But it was our sports arena. And anybody comes and wants to rip on it, hey, don't you're not going to get out of here alive.
Yeah, I think it appealed. If you're the type of person that say, you're like road tripping or traveling, and maybe you're like, hey, let's go find like a fun old dive bar. That's kind of what it appeal looks to me in appearance. With the wood paneling and that sort of thing, it was definitely you could tell it was a time capsule of a place. Yeah. So if that's kind of your thing, I think it would. Yeah, I think like the sportatorium is a good comparison. Like a lot of people are like, oh yeah, the place is a dump, but it's legendary.
It was our dump.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly. Right. Like in Dallas, right? Everybody can say the Sportatorium was a dump. You can say that with if you're from Dallas. But if you're outside of Dallas, don't besmirch it, because
And
that's, that's our building.
the thing is now is that the Portland Sports Arena is still standing and it's owned by a church.
And that's probably the reason why it's still there, quite honestly. One thing I don't know that people would realize unless they've visited it and if they're not from Portland is that it's in like a very residential neighborhood that's just outside of St. John's in Portland. But it's, yeah, I mean, for it, even it being a bowling alley, I mean, it's just really surrounded by homes. It's like there's not a lot of like commercial buildings around it or anything, so it's a very kind of peculiar destination for sure.
Kirby, you just brought up a memory that I haven't thought of in years about that is driving to the sports arena on Chautauqua Boulevard. It's like you're in a neighborhood and it's all nice houses and everything, and then all of a sudden, bam, here's all these cars and this one little building, and there was a grocery store right next to it, but that's it. I had forgotten all about that, that you just, where is this place? Where is it? Then all of a sudden there it jumps out at you with all the cars and the bad parking.
Yeah. I've got to throw this in there too, because I just got this tape from our, you know, you guys know Rob Connor, but he had this VHS that was in Sandy Barr's collection. I guess there was like a court hearing about Sandy Barr's flea market, which, you know, people have a lot of memories of. They would do that on, what was it, Sunday mornings after, you know, they did the taping Saturday night, and then Sunday mornings they'd have the flea markets there. And Sandy did that. And that ran for years. I think they started doing it, I want to say, in like 69 and like Memorial Day weekend or something. And they ran that thing. But it to some of the residents in the neighborhood, it became kind of a nuisance, because the flea market started to spill into the parking lot. And then you had people who weren't like sanctioned vendors who were literally selling like live chickens out the side of their trucks and stuff. And I have this like newsreel I should probably have digitized, but it's hilarious. I mean, it's just unreal, you know, and the community is so divided on it. Cause some people were like, I've lived here for 30 years, I have no problem with it. And then I guess you would have, you know, oh, like the transplants coming in and they're the ones raising issue with all this sort of stuff, you know, when it's, I don't know, it's humorous, you know, whatever your take is on it. But yeah, it's pretty wild, you know. There's like generators running, parking is absolutely unbelievable, you know.
Well, there's so much talent, right, that rose and came through Portland. I mean, we couldn't touch on them all, but I want to touch on two. We'll keep it to two. Probably the obvious ones, right? Let's first talk about how important is Roddy Piper to Portland wrestling?
Wow, where to start? I still remember his first couple of weeks in Portland, because he just had a different look about him. He was a young kid, but I remember him coming in with his bagpipes and he had to play his Klan song. And so you have Don Owen there saying, Roddy Piper wants to play his Klan song. And of course, everybody's booing in the whole bit. And that's what got him over. There was some kind of charisma about him that just connected. He was a great bad guy, but then, as Kirby alluded to, when he turned into a good guy, there was something between Rose and Piper that just, it was magic. Every territory has those one or two, three feuds that really kind of is what the territory is known for and what everybody in the area will know. And that's one thing that Piper did. He was just the charisma that we knew early on that everybody else discovered. He was Portland wrestling. I think he lit another fuse there when he came here in late 78. And by 79, when the Piper Rose feud started, it was amazing. It was really amazing. Ranks, I would say, maybe the top one or two feuds of all time in Portland.
I feel like, too, Portland, I don't know, you guys would probably speak better to this, but I don't think really that at that time, even just in wrestling at large, people weren't really seeing promos the way that he was doing it. We're very, like, energetic, you know, and really wired, I guess you can say. Because, you know, we watch these like Dutch Savage promos, and I actually really like his a lot, because it seems like he almost has like kind of a tough love version of the way he tells, like he talks about what he's going to do in a match or whatever, very composed, you know, and that sort of thing. But Piper was like always really wired. And the one thing I always thought you could really see is you could see his doppelgangers in Matt Bourne and Art Barr in the way they tried to do promos. I feel like it was totally from the Piper playbook, you know, just the way that he would do it with the amount of energy he had and that sort of thing, really try to come up for the promos and do that sort of thing.
Well, tell me, Kirby, right, you being a little younger, right, and seeing a different side of Roddy Piper, right, the national, the worldwide Roddy Piper.
Yeah.
When you went back and started diving into this older stuff, what, how did that grasp you? How did that impact you when you saw younger Piper and were this, you know, what was that like?
Well, I mean, that was the reason for wanting to even just get into this stuff, but just seeing him and seeing the footage that Rich restored there of like when Rose is like lighting his kilt in the crow's nest there, he lights his kilt on fire and it's like, you could see it's like spiraling kind of out of control. But those moments I thought was just like, wow, this is pretty cool. This is really special. You know, like it you definitely kind of felt like you were seeing something that was like a real treasure, you know, and yeah. The way that they played on each other, you know, that like Rose was kind of this like braggadocious heel that was so antagonizing, but like, you know, didn't look the part, but that just played to him so well. The way he understood psychology, I feel like he was like very advanced in his understanding of wrestling psychology. Rose was, because he got here in like 76, and I think he'd only really been wrestling for 4 years at that point. And I want to say he was probably only like 24, 25. He really understood the way to needle with the audience. And he had a foil in Piper, I think. And that feud, I think, is really the reason why I got so into Portland wrestling, was wanting to learn more about that and see that, you know.
Mike, what are some of your memories of Piper?
Well, this is, I think, really interesting, because at the time, Rose and Wiskowski were in and out a little bit, but still you'd consider them mainstays in the territory. Killer Brooks comes and debuts on the same day that Piper does, which was, as I'm looking at my book, October 7th, 1978. I don't think Don Owen had thought that Piper was going to have the impact that he did, because you've got Rose, Wiskowski. Brooks is the prototypical Portland wrestling heel. You know where he's going to be slotted. Piper had come from L.A. I don't think Don had a lot of respect for what L.A. was at that time. And the reason I mention that is you have a history of L.A. wrestlers coming to Portland and then not getting a push at all, like Hector Guerrero, Tim Flowers, guys who'd been really on top in L.A., then not getting much of an opportunity at all. But then Piper's charisma was just off the charts. And, you know, you couldn't, you know, if you were going to give him interview time, there's no way you could keep him out of main events. So I think that's really interesting, because honestly, as I look at the crew, when Piper came in, you know, especially with Brooks coming in on the same day, I don't think Don had plans for Piper, certainly to the level that, you know, one of the most popular wrestlers ever in Portland.
Yeah, and as all of you mentioned, right, I mean, a perfect segue, right? The other name I was going to throw out there, you can't mention Roddy Piper without mentioning Buddy Rose, right? And for those of us who are not from the Northwest, right, and have a different vision of Buddy Rose, right, from other television, whatever else. But Buddy Rose, I mean, is there a bigger name in Portland wrestling? I mean, how underappreciated in the grand scheme of things is Buddy Rose than his impact in Portland wrestling?
I don't think his impact in Portland is underrated at all. I think to wrestling fans around the country, right, it's underrated, because yeah, these tapes that of Rose's that I got from his widow and from Buddy before he passed. The one thing that his widow has really appreciated with all of this video being available out there now is that Buddy and Portland as a territory is being appreciated for being a lot greater, that people didn't know what the territory was all about. There are people that, sorry, Kirby, around Kirby's age that would think of Buddy Rose as the blowaway diet guy. And yep, that was it. They had no idea about his amazing work up here for all these years. And that's one of the things that I am most proud of with spending all the time and money and getting all of these tapes restored, is because now people know how great Playboy Buddy Rose was. He may not have been that great when he went to other territories, but he had his little bit of run in WWF in the early 80s. But in Portland, he was fantastic. He was the territory. Everybody, if there was no Rose, would there have been a Piper?
Right. Like, I mean, in that same, right, much later, you can say if there was no Piper, would there be a Hogan? But Kirby, he brought up an interesting point. What was your first exposure to Buddy Rose? Was it the Honestly, Portland stuff, Or was it the WWF stuff?
Even the WWF stuff, that was a little bit before my time, even, you know, of watching. But so it really was this footage, you know. I would kind of liken people's understanding of Buddy Rose that maybe aren't from the Northwest or haven't done like a deep dive on the tour, maybe to like, I don't know if this is a perfect comparison, but like maybe like a Bill Dundee to like Memphis or something, mm-hmm. where he's very recognized there as being integral to the territory, and people have so much respect for him, you know. And I think the same thing as well for guys like, I don't know, people outside of the Portland sphere really recognize how important like the Kangaroos were, Bull Ramos, Dutch Savage, you know, like the people that watched here, those names are big. And I've talked to a lot of people, and they'd be like, man, when the Kangaroos would come on TV, that they meant business, you know, like that was like, okay, you know, I got to stop what I'm doing and like watch this match or whatever. Same with like a Ramos or whatever. And I think Buddy was no different, you know. I think he really played that audience like a fiddle, and he was able to, like, I mean, his career here was, it's, you know, starts 76, and he just like he's hitting all tens like pretty much up through like the early 80s, you know, like up to 82, 83. Whether he's with, right off the bat, he was tagging with Ventura, you know, and then Wiskowski, and then he got the Sheepherders come in, and then he's, you know, he's got Adonis and Ron Starr as Emesis, and then, you know, with all the people around him, and so he's just so integral to the territory. I don't think you can really like overstate how important he was.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that, right? As the territories fade into a nationalized wrestling, right? There's every territory had these guys that were stars, were draws, were attractions, who were doing enhancement stuff in the WWF or whatever later, because they had to work, right? They had to find something, and everything was drying up, and that's kind of the shame, right? That these guys, because there's so much tape left exists of that stuff, but not their prime stuff, that they're viewed a certain way. But even Buddy Rose, though, even in the stuff he did in the WWF, you could see that charisma. You can see that personality, even then, with those limited opportunities, you could see it present itself. He still knew how to work that camera and get himself over, even in an enhancement role when he was doing that kind of stuff. Mike, tell us, what do you think? I mean, tell us some of your memories of Buddy Rose.
Well, we just talked about how Don's expectation of Roddy Piper, we didn't know. Buddy Rose, when he debuted, it's such a unique situation because Don always had a pattern. The new heel comes in, he squashes somebody the first week, second week, maybe he wins a battle royal. You can see that's the person that's going to get the big push. With Buddy, it was different than any other heel, and here's how. He came in, and remember, before this, he was just Paul Pershman in the AWA. He came directly from Texas, you know, strictly preliminary. And I know that he had Red Bastien's word to back him, but Buddy came in and main evented on his debut night, which is absolutely unheard of. And so he really had to have some words and confidence behind him for Don to put him in that position. And he started teaming with Jesse Ventura, and the opening, his debut, they beat Jimmy Snuka and Savage. So that established him immediately. And it was a really interesting pairing because you've got Ventura, who's the strong, at that time, just jacked up, muscular guy. And Buddy, who was in good shape, that deceptive good shape, but still had a little softness to his physique, which got him heat, you know, immense heat just by his appearance. And then he was able to talk to Ventura. There's another side note that I find fascinating. Jesse Ventura's run, especially his first 6 months, they never let him say a word. Bull Ramos was his manager. They never let Jesse say a word. And I just find it fascinating to where he evolved to. But Buddy, I think, established himself with his work and also his mind, because Portland didn't have a booker it was just like the top guys just all got together and figured out what it was going to be. And maybe Don had a little bit of input. But I think that may be one of the reasons why Buddy stayed so long. He knew how to play the game and he kept himself on top, but he kept himself on top by involving other people to make good opponents for himself.
Yeah, and I mean, go ahead, Rich.
One thing that Buddy told me was that he enjoyed working with his friends, and he'd bring his friends into town, like the sheep herders, who he teamed with and then went up against. Jay Youngblood is one guy who he was very good friends with and brought him in. Rick Martel is somebody who was a good friend. Roddy Piper, they were friends, and he brought these people in. Kurt Hennig, yes. And he would bring these people in, and he said, it was so much fun working with your friends. And if you look back, these guys who he had the major programs with were friends of his.
I'm sorry, Rich. Look how good of workers all those guys that we mentioned were.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every single one of them.
And one thing about Buddy as well, when he came into town, we talked about Bull Ramos and the Kangaroos. As bad guys, they scared you. As a kid, they scared me. They came up and they were fire and brimstone. But when Buddy came in, he wasn't fire and brimstone. He was the arrogant little dink that you wanted to slap around and you wanted to see him get slapped around. And so he was a different kind of heel than we had been exposed to here in Portland.
Yeah, and we talked about that loyal. No, go ahead, Kirby.
Well, I was just going to say, he kind of, it's almost like the Ole Anderson principle. Like, he found the territory and he was able to homestead it for years. And like that, that is the goal of the territory system. And people didn't tire of seeing him against whoever, whether it was Jay Youngblood or Piper or whoever. Like that was the goal, you know, and he found his place and he made it work, you know?
Yeah. And we mentioned earlier, right, that loyalty to Portland and to Don, right? Even when a lot of times when Buddy was doing TV work in New York, he was still coming back and doing shots in Portland, right? It's still working for them because that was home. Yeah. That was his territory. That was his promotion. And that never left him. And a lot of people forget about Buddy, right? On the first WrestleMania card, right? He came into WWF in a different light at first, was on that first WrestleMania. And he's kind of one of those unheralded talents.
And Mike, I don't know if you or Dave, if you can confirm this. I had heard stories that the reason that they made him the executioner and put a hood on him is that the WWF had plans to bring Buddy back as main event talent, and they didn't want him to be in a squash match there at WrestleMania. Is that an old wives' tale, or does anybody know about that?
I'm not certain, but that certainly makes sense.
I've heard like similar, yeah, you know, maybe just to at the least protect him, because I know he was wearing his, if you notice, he's wearing his snakeskin boots, which said Rose, and he's wearing tape over them to obscure his name, maybe to do him service, and that, yeah, he's not, you know, being thought of as an underneath guy or whatever.
Well, essentially, even when he's doing, you know, WWF enhancement, I mean, he still had a gimmick, a personality, right? He was doing the weight loss protein, the weight loss powder. He even had, they were giving him something, or he was allowing him to do something, even at that level, and it was, you know, so I don't know. It's odd that they didn't let him get a little more, but they certainly did, you know, appreciate some of his talents and what he brought to the table.
It seems that Well, I was going to say, it seems that anybody who's like a Portland wrestling fan, or like, you know, if that is their bread and butter, it seems like his run in the WWF in those later years is always kind of a blemish. Like everybody's kind of like, yeah, there's that. And it's almost like you'd rather see him almost in like a Bobby Heenan type role, where he could have been like a manager that could take bumps and do something and have a stable that maybe would have, you know, I think suited us fans better or something. Because it is kind of hard to just see him where it is. Literally, the gimmick is look at the size of him, but he's also able to take bumps and stuff, but he's losing to every single person on the card, you know?
Yeah.
In exceptional fashion, I guess, but, you know, like, but that's about it, you know?
I think one thing that we should mention is his bumping ability, even when he got heavy. You know, he had that unique bump where he would hook his toes on the middle rope as he's going outside. And you never saw anybody else do that bump. That really helped keep him over, and he was so good at taking bumps.
Yeah,
being in Portland, I don't know how many wrestlers when they pass get a news story about them. Mm. It was big news on all the Portland TV stations when Buddy passed in 2009. Prior to that, we would hang out every so often, and I will always remember going to Buddy's favorite, if you can believe this, all you can eat Chinese food place in Vancouver. And so we go in there, and it was a Saturday afternoon, and people, this was maybe in 2004, 2005, people still knew Buddy, and they just glommed onto him, and Buddy loved it. He had turned into kind of everybody's favorite good guy. They loved to hate him in years gone by, but in his later years, he became such an icon in Portland. Once again, he still lived here, that people just loved him. And seeing everybody just go towards him in this restaurant, it did my heart good, because it's like, I know Buddy loved that, and he took time with everybody.
I had a friend that, you know, mentioned the same thing, like when he was, I guess, either middle school or high school, talking about seeing Buddy Rose at the Jansen Beach Denny's, you know, and just being like, hey, Buddy Rose. And he would, you know, kind of point back, or like, he loved that attention. You know, he was never shy from the limelight, you know.
But you never wanted to be in a car with Buddy when he was driving. I only rode in a car once with Buddy, and I swore I would never do it again, because he was in this big old Cadillac, and he had cable TV in his Cadillac, and he knew that I was a big Chicago Cubs fan. So while he's driving, he has one arm over here and he's trying to adjust to WGN so I could see the Cubs game. Meanwhile, we're still going 60, 70 miles an hour down the road. And then during that same trip, he says, hey, let's go see Tammy, his wife, because she was working. And so he goes and does this huge U-turn right in this intersection. It's like, there are cars out there. And it's like, Buddy had no fear. I had lots of it that day, but he had no fear. And I swore I would never ride in another car with Playboy Buddy Rose.
Well, and I know I said two names, but another name that you guys have all mentioned at various times is Dutch Savage, who may not be familiar to a lot of people outside of the Northwest. Not only was he a talent, right, but in 76, he actually bought into the territory, correct? How did that happen? What did that have a lot of impact in the promotion?
I don't know that he bought in, but I know he started running the Washington side of the promotion, because it had been dark ever since Harry Elliott stopped promoting Seattle, I want to say in like 71, which is why the whole Superstar Championship Wrestling was able to happen with Dean Silverstone doing the promotion, because they weren't running Washington anymore. But I don't know if he was actually ever bought in, but I think he probably just paid his dues to Don for the booking or whatever of the talent or something. But I don't know, Mikey might know probably more about that.
Dutch was a salty character, that's for sure. Dutch will tell you that he definitely bought in. I did an interview with Dutch one time, and it was such an experience, because I was going to do an interview one day, and I called. He was working at a real estate office. I called. He had stepped out, and then I needed to step out. My son had left homework at school. I needed to take him to school. So the next day I called Dutch, and he goes, you didn't call me yesterday. He's angry. I go, I did call you. You stepped out, and then I needed to, you know, that explanation. And it was like, okay. Well, what do you got for me, you know? And we started doing an interview, and he did such a fantastic job. I don't know if he forgot what we were, you know, because I told him, this is, I have a bulletin this is going to be for publication, for a bulletin. He was as honest and as forthright as he ever could be. We finished the interview and I just said, thanks, you did a fantastic job. And he immediately kind of turned and he goes, you can't use this. And I'm like, well, you know, it was an interview. That's what we were, you know, trying to do. He goes, you can't use this. I will sue you. So I took that seriously and I held on to that interview for 7 or 8 years until Dutch passed. And then I put it in the bulletin because I have no doubt he probably would have tried to sue me.
I've heard funny stories about Dutch too, about like somebody, I can't remember who I heard this from. I think this was like Rob Connor told me he heard this from a friend, but that he had befriended Dutch and there was a time they went out fishing on a lake or something. And while he's out fishing, you know, the guy's kind of asking about wrestling, whether it's on the up and up or whatever. And then, you know, Dutch is like saying how, oh, I can, you know, I used to do this, whatever, like a sleeper kind of hold or whatever. I could, you know, I could show you right now while they're in the middle of a lake, you know, nobody else around and stuff. So I think he kind of like played kayfabe to the hilt, like to the very end, you know, like it's, he had that tough love persona. And I don't know that like when he switched from heel to babyface, that much really changed in his delivery or his mannerism, you know. That's why I almost say he's kind of like a tweener type person, you know. It's like his whole manner of like the way he wrestled and did his interviews never really seemed to change. I always reference this, but that PBS documentary The Savage I think is absolutely essential viewing for anybody who just likes territorial wrestling, where it's the Dutch Savage and Iron Sheik feud there, where they have it culminates to the iron the coal miner's glove match. But one of the things I love is the way he says, oh, you know, it can get pretty tough in there. Things might get a little ringy. Is one of the things he says in there. It just gets me, you know? Yeah.
Well, talk to me about in 1985, right? There was a big event held to honor the Owen family, right? For 60 years of professional wrestling. It was a very unique event too, right? Because pretty much every major promotion in remaining territory sent some talent. Mike or Rich, were either of you at this event?
Yes, I was.
Yeah, I had front row.
All right. Well, tell us about this event and how unique was it for that time?
Well, yeah, Don never wanted to do an event of that size. And, there was somebody had said that it was Channel 12 who kind of inquired, you know, with this milestone coming up of them being in business for 60 years, kind of persuaded him to run at the Portland Coliseum. And they loaded up the talent. On top was Ric Flair and Billy Jack. Roddy Piper came against Buddy Rose, and that was an undercard. AWA title was, I believe, Rick Martel and Mike Miller, if I remember right. Yep. Road Warriors versus the Hennings. And yeah, those top four or five matches were just, you know, unbelievable. And that, you know, that card was the talk of the country for that. You know, such a quality card. Also, the extra aspect of Piper coming and working a show that wasn't WWE. And the undercard was solid as well. I will never forget the first time I'd ever seen the Road Warriors. And in an arena that big, when their music hit, literally goosebumps on my arms.
Well, one thing about the Piper-Rose match is that this was in 85 when Piper was far and away the number one heel in WWF. Yeah,
right.
Despised by everybody. The pop for him when he was announced, you can, if you watch the video, he comes out and he has the real stern Roddy Piper look. Then all of a sudden you see this big grin come on his face when he's getting the cheers like it was 1980 all over again.
That was, I want to say it was like a month or two right after WrestleMania. So
yeah,
there's that. I want to say leading up to that too, he does a promotional thing on local news where he is in like heel gimmick, but there's still the adoration from the local fans for him. I'm sure it's on YouTube, and I can't remember what the segment was, and maybe you guys remember, but, and you know, like even at one of these kids in the audience is asking a question to him about like, what, like, why now you're a bad guy on national TV, but you know, like what changed? And, you know, he kind of has the whole rap of like, well, I didn't change, the whole, you know, the audience turned on me. That's them, you know, really not really breaking or whatever. But yeah, like Rich said, there's no way that crowd was going to boo him. It's just not going to happen. And also the other thing too, I don't think people really know, like people know of that card, but Portland was on really lean times in 85, 86. I mean, those are kind of like the dark ages for the territory because they lost all their top stars in the national expansion of the WWF. I mean, like Rip Oliver, I think, was over in WWF for a spell as like the Super Ninja or something. So they really had nobody to lean on. I want to say maybe Tom Zink came in around that time or something, but it was really, really lean times for Portland wrestling. So that was a big card, but you look at some of the from Rich's tapes, and I've never seen like the Portland sports arena be so visibly bare, like where there's just empty seats in that arena. And because when you see it packed out, it looks like it's a full house, and you kind of, it's hard to get a read on just how big that building is. But when you see it empty like that, you're like, whoa, that place is kind of dinky. You know, it looks real small time. So it's an interesting juxtaposition because I want to say what they did, like 10,000 people for that supercard there.
Yeah.
And no, go ahead, Mike.
The one thing that Kirby alluded to, you had a really drop in talent, and not to disparage, but you had Ricky Vaughn come in, and with his look, he got shot up to the main events. Mike Miller, a unique situation because he'd been around for a while as strictly preliminary and just kind of one of the last men left. He got pushed up. I think I've written at the beginning of 85, he was in the strictly preliminaries. And by Christmas of 85, he was in the main event in a cage match on Christmas night. Also, the Rip Oliver wasn't there in 85 for a time period, but his booking in 86 was so bad. There just was not anything going on TV in through 87. You know, they would have maybe one or two turns during the entire year. And then Grappler came in 77, in September of 77. And it was such a stark difference because he had angles and issues and things more than just one, you know, and fans just got overloaded in a good way. It was exciting again. And it was just different points of view of booking. But 85 and 86 and early 87 were pretty lean in Portland.
I would say mid 86 to when Grappler came in the late summer of 87. Those are some of the tougher shows for me to watch because your top baby faces were Coco Samoa, who had been a curtain puller for 10 years here, Scott Doring, Brady Boone. Nothing bad about them, but they had no charisma. There was nothing exciting about them at all. They didn't give you a reason to watch or want to go down to the arena.
They couldn't carry a promotion.
Yeah.
No. That's what Grappler did, is he did a really good job. And even though it's not my favorite era, he did a really good job of like fostering and building new talent. Like when you start to see, you know, it's like you're like seeing the Southern Rockers and they're learning on the fly, whether it's Steve Dahl and Scott Peterson or Rex King. But it's like there is a charisma in these young guys and they're learning their trade. But like it's you can buy into it, you know.
Yeah, which is all kind of a reflection of territorial wrestling in general at that time, right? Yeah. I mean, it was not only was the WWF and the Vince McMahon thing and picking talent and whatever else, but it was just, you know, everything was becoming nationalized, right? Cable TV, everything else, right? There was the regional stuff was kind of fading. You know, you have all that, right? The changing atmosphere of pro wrestling. some problem with the TV, the primary TV sponsor, and everything else, right, led to Don retiring and kind of closing his aspect of it in 92. And I think Kirby mentioned it earlier, right? There was some other guys that kind of tried to keep it alive, right? Sandy Barr purchased then, you know, bought it, the rights in 92, ran for a while. You know, Don Cost ran for a while with Piper. Different guys tried to do some Portland wrestling. But were any of them even shadows of the previous magic? I mean, was there any spark there? Or had kind of the time passed?
For me as a wrestling fan, I think the time had passed because the original Portland wrestling was so near and dear to my heart for so many years. It's I think it was George Harrison one time when he was asked about the Beatles getting back together. He said it'd be like trying to reheat a souffle. It's just not the same.
Yeah.
And these guys who have been working on the various promotions since Donovan went away in 92, I'm sure they're great talent, but it's not Portland wrestling. It's not the Portland sports arena.
Yeah.
I think ultimately, like, the change in culture is also one of the things that people don't really talk about that also kind of killed the territories too. The world changed. Yep. And that grassroots style wrestling that people grew up and loved, especially on regional television, or even when you're watching Georgia Championship being broadcast on TBS, it still like had a different look. And I just think that culture changed and it shifted. And I think trying to capture that is impossible, you know?
Well, right. Because regional in general just faded, right? I mean, someone earlier mentioned a regional, I don't know what they, I can't remember how it came up. Okay. A regional cartoon host or kid show, yeah. Right? Every territory had that, right? Kids show host, mm-hmm. You know, horror host, different things like that. By this time, all that was fading. Everything was fading because there was a rise in cable TV and a nationalization of television and entertainment in general. And it was just the landscape was changing. And, you know, all your regional type entertainment was starting to kind of fade and everything was changing. And it's being, you know, kind of a lost thing.
Yeah, oh, yeah. It was thought of lesser than, right? Because
right,
of,
yeah.
You know.
You have to give Don Owen credit, I think, though, for hanging in there. I think
he did, yeah.
Was it, along with Memphis, were they the last two major regional promotions? So give him credit for hanging in there. And maybe being up here in Portland helped us because that was, we had the Trailblazers and that was it. We had Portland wrestling and it was such a legendary thing that maybe that helped it stick around a few more years and then other promotions.
Yeah. Well, the Northwest is kind of unique, right? It's almost, for lack of a better term, a little more secluded than certain other regions of the country. Right. So maybe that's, you know, maybe part of it. Right. I mean, I've heard again, like I mentioned with Kirby, about the music scene, I heard, you know, some of the Northwest, you didn't get some of the major music acts sometimes because of the seclusion, the weather, the different aspects. So there was a little more of a scene, right? A regional scene that lasted a little bit longer because of that quote unquote seclusion. And, but yeah, I mean, Don, you know, I mean, Memphis hung around. Yeah. But they had WWE involvement there towards the end and everything else. And, you know, Don did it on his own for a long, long time. And had it not been for the major problem with that primary TV sponsor, he could have gone a little bit longer. Who knows? Well, I
don't know. And Mike Kirby, you can jump in on this as well. What I had heard is that what the way the Portland wrestling worked is that Don did not pay. He didn't get any money from the sponsors. It was all the TV got all that. Where Don made his money off TV was being able to promote all of his shows. But then we had the bankruptcy with the major sponsor, Tom Peterson, who had been there since day one. But also WWF comes in and says, we will pay you $1,500 a week to run our show.
Yeah.
But you can't run any of the wrestling on your show. So Portland Wrestling goes from having to pay all their production people every week to produce a local show to not having to pay that money. And in turn, they're getting money now for just running this show for 1 hour a week. And from a business standpoint, it made perfect sense for the management of KPTV to say, yeah, we'll take the WWF money and goodbye Portland Wrestling.
Which is fun. What they were doing in most of the territories, right?
Yeah.
Going in and saying, hey, we'll pay you for the time if you just don't air these guys.
And it seems like Don was happy to stay in his own lane with wrestling, right? Like, I mean, he never had invested in his production budget. You know, like people joke that it was a two-camera shoot that were like 5 feet apart, essentially the same angle, you know? There was never really any intention to like update it or, you know, like they never going to do like the world class thing where they had a camera down by the ring and then the far away, you know, they were happy to just kind of be doing their thing, you know, in the same way too. I don't really imagine like Don politicking as an NWA member. Like it seems like he was happy to be doing his own thing. He had a promotion that worked and, you know, it was fine as it was running for so long. And he was happy just doing that, you know, cause he also had a cattle ranch that he took care of and other things. So this was like the family business, you know?
And it took Roddy Piper to come in and basically tell Don that you have to, you know, evolve with the times, because Portland Wrestling was always first two matches, 50-minute time limit. And that was it. Then you had the best 2 out of 3 for your last match. That was it. And Piper came in, had him switch things around a little bit. The Crow's Nest area, if you look on the older matches or the older tapes, it was chicken wire around the whole area. And it looked kind of primitive. And Piper kind of had him dress that up a little bit. And so Portland Wrestling had a different look and format the last couple of years. But Don Owen did not want to make those changes.
It seems like too, like the Rose Garden was a segment that Buddy Rose was doing there in those later years. That seemed like an effort to try to almost mimic the WWF style. And then there was the Fiesta Garden with Al Madrill. Like it seemed like they kind of started, as the audience was changing towards kids, they started leaning more into that as well, making the product. And there's also the whole commission thing where Bruce Anderson was doing away with blood. So it seemed like they really had to pander to being like, okay, children are watching WWF. This is the product that they're seeing. We need to maybe start focusing more on that from a booking standpoint and for the promotion. And so that's, you know, with like Beetlejuice as a gimmick and things like that, you know, like was it Farmer Carl Stiles? Just kind of everybody had kind of a gimmick, you know, there.
Or Carl Stiles, he had a different gimmick every couple of weeks, it seemed like.
Yeah. I always joke that Brian Adams was like, he had like gimmick salad, you know, he's like, what, it was Midnight Soldier and, you know, Crush and Brian Adams and Super Ninja or whatever he was. He had a bunch too, you know.
Well, a minute ago, I mentioned Don Cost. I just want to touch on that just for a moment because, right, he recently passed away. He was the kind of the announcer or the broadcaster for what, for about a 10-year period there, right? Yeah. From the early 80s to the early 90s.
To the Frank Bottom and the original announcer
passed away in
October of 82. And then Don Koss took over for Frank.
Yeah. And it was kind of from what I understand, what I heard and read, right? Was it kind of a, nobody was real sure what happened at first because you guys mentioned that someone mentioned the Portland Wrestling Expo. I had heard that everybody was there and was like, hey, where's Don? Why isn't Don here? And when they kind of looked into it, they found out he had passed away, and it was kind of caught everybody off guard a little bit.
Yeah. There was one fellow there who mentioned that he thought that, he had done a little bit of exploring, and he found Don Koss on Find a Grave and asked if I had known anything about that. And I hadn't heard anything. And I think from him, people did a little more exploring and to discover that he had passed.
Yeah. Well, and let's speak just for a moment here before we wrap up on the expo, right? This just happened, just a few weeks ago. A pretty, you know, big thing, you know, pretty cool. What was that like being there? I know, Kirby, you had a lot of your stuff there and different things. What was that event like?
It was cool. I mean, so whenever I do these sort of events, I kind of bring a lot of my memorabilia. Like you see, I have my Dutch Savage jacket. You know, I have like Piper's trunks. I got some of Buddy's trunks and a bunch of like kind of collage boards. So it's kind of like a little interactive pop-up style thing. So that's what I try to do. And it's just cool for people to come in and to hear the memories that people have. Sort of like what Mike was saying earlier. Everybody always has a story about somebody who's like, oh, I remember seeing Jimmy Snuka at like the 7-Eleven buying beer, you know, or Lonnie Main getting beer and getting into his Corvette and driving and stuff. So there's always, everybody always has those type of stories. And that's like kind of the stuff I love hearing, you know? So it's cool to pick the brains of the folks that were there that got to go and hear all their stories. And then the fun part too, is kind of when they're telling their stories, you could kind of be like, okay, so this person was going like in like 83 based on the names they're mentioning and stuff like that. You can kind of start to piece together, you know, who was there at what times and stuff like that. So, you know, it was really cool. I mean, I think all of us weren't really sure what the expectations was, but it was awesome. I think, you know, I'd love to do another one. I'd love to petition for a guy like Rip Rogers to be there, because I know that guy's full of stories. And he constantly sings the praises of Buddy Rose and, like, just that mind he had for wrestling. Like, I think he would be a great person for a panel, you know. Well,
there's, Rip, you know, definitely has stories.
Yes, yeah. You know.
And he's not afraid to tell them.
Yeah, that's right. I
thought it was fun as well, just to talk to a lot of the wrestlers finally face to face, who I had had correspondence with over the last couple of years. Because one thing that I've done with this restored footage that I have from Buddy's collection is that I've made it a point to give these guys all the footage I have of their work in Portland.
Yeah. Right.
And so a couple days ago, I sent Dave Sierra a hard drive of like 100 different shows of him that I have. Wow. Yeah. Ricky Santana, we had a great conversation, and he has none of his Portland footage. I sent him some stuff. I've done that over the years for Piper, for Rip Rogers. He's used some on his podcast that he's done before they passed away. Matt Bourne, Bobby Jaggers. And once again, Piper sent me an amazing email after I sent his, and just, he said, thank you so much for all this, my friend. We got to get together someday, have a Coke and talk about the good old days. And he passed away a couple weeks later.
Yeah.
Rip Oliver, I sent him a bunch of stuff, and he sent me a message saying how grateful he was. He had lost everything he had in a flood or a hurricane or something when he was in Florida. And he said, now my grandkids have a chance to see what their grandpappy did for a living. And so that's been one of the things I've really loved doing with this footage. And Mike Miller actually sent me his tapes so I could convert those for him. Oh. And it for me, it was nice to be able to talk to these guys, and they thank me. But I say the real guy you have to thank is Buddy Rose. He's the guy who had the foresight to tape all this stuff, and not just tape it, but save it.
Yeah.
And after he passed, all of his VHS tapes that his wife gave me, there were about 900 that I had to go through to collect stuff. And Buddy, God love him, he didn't label anything. And if he did label it, it was wrong.
But that sounds right.
Thanks to him, that's why we have almost 500 hours of Portland wrestling footage. Because before this, the only stuff I had seen is stuff I had gotten in the early days of tape trading. And they would be maybe like sixth or seventh generation. You could barely see what was on there. But it was Portland, so I enjoyed it. And now, once again, God love you, Buddy. He has exposed Portland wrestling to everybody now.
Still giving.
Yep.
All right. Well, before we close out here, I'm going to give you guys a chance. If anything you want to plug, wrestling or otherwise, Mike, you're the author of the group. You got several books out. Is there anything new you're working on that you can talk to us about yet?
Well, I have here. I'll hold them up. I have three different versions of Excitement in the Air, and those are all interviews that were done from my bulletin. And I ran a bulletin called Ring Around the Northwest for 30 years.
Yep.
Had a chance to interview lots and lots of people, from Lou Thesz, Don Leo Jonathan, Bull Ramus, Dutch Savage, on and on and on, probably over 100.
Two volumes of that, right? Out?
Mm-hmm. Three volumes.
Oh, three volumes. Okay. Oh, yeah. There you go.
Third one has Grappler, Mike Miller.
There you go.
Tony Bourne, Haru Suzuki. And this was some interviews in this one that were done recently after the Bulletin had ended. Grappler and Mike Miller and Joey Jackson, some Portland guys. So some current interviews, or at least more recent interviews. Katie barred the door.
Yep.
Was right. History of Portland Wrestling. This is probably the most, if you only want to buy one book, this is probably the one that you, will give you the most.
That kind of the overview, right?
Yeah, I have another that I don't have in front of me. It's called the Encyclopedia of Portland Wrestling.
Yep.
Every wrestler that appeared at the Portland Sports Arena the entire way, even if it was a wrestler who didn't appear on TV and only appeared in a clipping of a result from the newspaper, we at least included him.
There you go.
There you go. Rich has got it.
There you go.
And there's, we found one wrestler that we forgot, Woody Farmer.
Oh.
And no reason why, just one wrestler slipped up on us. I also have, it's not Portland, but it's the history of Hawaii wrestling.
Yeah.
It's called, Oh Yeah, History of Hawaii Wrestling.
Pampero Furpro Ross, there, right?
Pardon?
That Pampero Furpro there on the cover there?
Yeah. This was a lot of fun. I have so much reverence for Hawaii wrestling just because of their situation. A lot of interesting history of what wrestling was like or what life in Hawaii was like, especially at Pearl Harbor time.
And a unique territory, right? Because it was a stopover on the way to Japan and back a lot of times.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
And I had a chance to interview Lord Blears and Ed Francis when they were alive. So they're and other wrestlers who mentioned Rick Martel I had interviewed him and he talked about Hawaii. Pampero Furpo talked about Hawaii. So there's some firsthand accounts of that as well.
So anything in the works for the future or not quite yet?
The last little book I did was my experiences as a teacher. I don't have that in front of me. That was just a lot of fun. I'm not working on anything right now.
Well, you never know when the bug will hit.
For Mike's books, the one thing I love about, especially Katie Barred the Door and the Encyclopedia of Portland Wrestling, those aren't books that you have to pick up and read cover to cover. You can pick it up and just open up any page.
Yeah.
And there's amazing information on there. And those are kind of the kind of reference books I like because once again, you can just go and pick a page and there's something great on there.
That's right.
Thanks, Reg.
Well, yeah. All right, Kirby, you got the music, kind of you got the collection. What do you got going on?
Well, that kind of segues into kind of what I've been working on. And I have Mike's books dog-eared like crazy right now because essentially what I'm trying to do is curate a pictorial history on the wrestling in the Northwest, you know, being Portland wrestling. And one of the things I've collected over these years is photography and negatives and things like that all across the territory from, and hopefully this will bring, you know, some prominence to the names of these people that shot photography. But like, I know Mike was in correspondence with Ron Evans, you know, in the past, and I have Ron Evans photo archives. He used to shoot photos in Medford, Oregon, which is pretty much about as far south as the territory went. And he shot in the Medford Armory from like around 73 to 76 and then took a break. And then he started doing photos again in the 80s. I have Bob Lynn's photography archive that actually Mike tipped me off to getting that. And so Bob Lynn did a lot of photography in the Salem at the Salem Grand Theater. And I have tons of stuff for Portland. I have like a lot of Ken Hamblin, who is a mutual friend of all of ours, his photography from Tacoma. So I'm trying to do as linear as a history of the history of Portland wrestling, essentially from the Portland Sports Arena years up until the very end. Originally, I was going to kind of do a cutoff in the 80s, because for me, that's kind of where the heart and soul of the promotion was. But I don't know if I will ever be doing another project like this again. So I was like, I might as well just use all the resources I have and try to make this book. But it's going to be kind of a coffee table style book. So I'm in the process of doing that. And I'm using Mike's book along the way, just like every day. That's what I've been working on before you got on here. That's what I'm probably going to continue to work on when we wrap up. So there, you can look forward to that. I have no idea when that will be done, but I'm going to be plugging away at it this year. So yeah. And then the last thing I did, as I mentioned, Ken Hamblin, I put out his footage. He shot Super 8 millimeter footage of Tacoma wrestling, you know, big time wrestling as it's known in Washington. And he shot from like 78 to 80. And so there's all the names that we mentioned before, like Piper and Rose, you know, Wiskowski, Martel, Sheepherders. And a lot of these matches too are cool. They're stipulation style matches, you know, that they were trying to get tickets for people to come out to all these shows in the, on the territory. So I have that, and I did it on a VHS as kind of a love letter to the tape trading days of yeah, you know, back then. So that's about an hour and a half of footage that people haven't seen that I just put out. I have other little tchotchkes too. I just did these beer koozies, the Portland wrestling. I just did a run of satin jackets, which I had at the expo, and a bunch of other stuff. So that's all on my, I have a Big Cartel website, Big Cartel, yeah, which is classicportlandwrestling.bigcartel.com. If you go to my Instagram, it's on the link there. I have a Twitter, which is PDX Sports Arena. I have the link in the bio there. So if you're interested in any of that sort of stuff, it's all.
Kind of your central hub is, you kind of focus on Instagram a lot, right? Because because the picture driven.
Yeah. You know, it's all picture based. A lot of it. Yeah. It's pictorial stuff. So, you know, and on, unfortunately, like on Twitter, my stuff kind of gets lost in the algorithm, you know, Twitter is just about like whatever people are hot about at the moment, it seems like. So sometimes it gets lost in the shuffle. I don't know that the format I exist with works as best there, but I'm on there too. So
yeah, you're a good follow on Instagram. I enjoy your stuff.
But thank you.
Keep me posted on the book, and I'll keep listeners posted. We'll go through that. And again, I know it's not related to Portland wrestling, but like we mentioned, you do have a band, right? Are you are you out there on the streaming platforms?
Yeah, we're on Spotify. So we're called Donava. It's Danava for, I guess, fans of kind of the guitar heroics of the 70s. Lots of harmonies and stuff. Whenever we're kind of try to put in layman's terms, I say we're somewhere between Rush and Iron Maiden, I guess. if you like all that old stuff, you know, Johnny Winter, Montrose, Thin Lizzy, all that stuff. Well, we're kind of right there and all that. So
if you already got Spotify, it doesn't cost anything to give you a check.
That's right.
Give you a listen, right? You're out there. You do lots of shows. I've noticed on your
We did some touring the last couple years because we had a new album in last year? I don't know. We did like we did a European tour, U.S. tour, and then a West Coast tour. So now we're kind of coming down from that. So we're just doing some more local shows coming up now. But yeah, well,
like I said, check him out on Spotify if you like that. You can deep dive and maybe check him on your ear. Rich, you're obviously busy with the Trailblazers.
For another couple of weeks anyhow.
Yeah. So you got anything else brewing out there?
Well, what I think everybody knows about is the external hard drive of all the Portland wrestling footage I now have available just on, and you know, that's about 500 hours of footage right there that I have available. And just for your viewers here, I'll give a little taste of what these tapes look like, the original ones. Kirby has most of these now. There's one that I kept because the way this entire thing came about is one time I'm asking Buddy, and I said, I would really love to see Lonnie Mane in Portland. It's too bad there's no footage of Lonnie Mane in Portland. And he goes, oh, I have some. And we go into his garage, and he has this huge duffel bag of these old tapes. And this is what these tapes look like. This one is as busted, he gave all of these, and he showed me this, and see if it says born Maine and has the date on there. And it's like, oh, holy crap. I got to get that. He said, you can have them. I have no way to play them anymore. I'm just going to toss them. And so I took them, and it took me about a year to figure out what the format was. And my friends in production with the Blazers, who were wrestling fans, they helped me out. And we found out it was an old 1970s format that predated VHS and Beta, put out by Quasar, called the Great Time Machine. And so then it was a case of trying to find a machine. So that took another couple of years. And there was a guy who, for the TV show Lost, he provided all the stuff that was down in their dungeon or whatever it was, all the video and audio equipment. And he sent me this machine. As it turns out, there was a place about 5 miles away from me that could repair it. So they replaced all the belts, cleaned it up and the whole bit, and started playing this. And the problem is, you can't see it on here. I can see it on this one. These were in Buddy's garage for over 20 years. Not well protected, so mold and mildew and everything gets on these tapes. Yeah. I'm playing the tapes. The mold from all of that gums up the tape heads. So I got to go, take it back in, spend another $100 about once a week, get these tape heads cleaned. And finally, I'm able to get everything taken care of. If you watch this footage, it looks like there's bad tracking on there. And that's not tracking. It's where the mold had eaten through the tape. And so there's nothing on there. But that's where I have Lonnie Mane. I have Jesse Ventura. I have Jimmy Snuka. I have the infamous match we talked about, the four-man or eight-man tag match that led to the Piper-Rose feud. That's some great stuff on there. Early Gino Hernandez, when he was just a kid wrestling in Portland, that's all on there. So, yeah, I'm glad Buddy didn't do that. And with the VHS tapes after Buddy passed, his wife wanted to know how she was going to give him to Goodwill or put a couple boxes a week in a dumpster. It's like, no, 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 no. So there are a couple of them here. I took all of them, about 900 in all. Like this one is from March of 1980. Sheep Herders and Rose interview, Buddy versus Luke for hair. So that's the Roddy Piper, Luke Williams hair match. Here's wrestling, Rose and Schultz on there. So anyhow, all of these that's what I spent years transferring over, and they are now all available on this little puppy here. Sold some of them at the expo, which was nice. I've gotten great reviews on them. So people can get in touch with me on Facebook. I'm not on Twitter or Instagram, but they can just get to me directly, Rich Patterson on Facebook, or we have our Facebook group that you know about, Dave, Fans of Portland Wrestling.
Yep.
They can email me at Portland Wrestling Video, no S, Portland Wrestling Video at yahoo.com. I will send them the complete list. This is what I had at the expo. This is all of the matches, everything on there, so they can see everything that's included.
All right. Well,
that's my plug.
There you go. And mentioning, I forgot to ask about the social media, Kirby. We said your Instagram, right? Is it Classic Portland Wrestling? Is that what it's called?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
There you go. That's the best way to find Kirby. You got some links up there for the Big Cartel on the Instagram and everything else. So, you know, follow him on Instagram. Mike, do you have a kind of a central, what's the best way for social media, or do you kind of discourage people?
my books are on Amazon. That's
there you the go. Yep.
If you're interested, I'm on Facebook. That's about it.
Yeah. And if you look up, Mike
quit
Rogers
laughing
on
at me.
Yeah. I'm jealous, man. I'll be there someday.
Yeah. And if you look at Mike on Amazon, they all come up. Mike Rogers with a D. There's a D in there. And I'm assuming if you just look up Portland Wrestling, they'll probably come up. And it should be pretty easy to find. So go check those out. Plenty of Mike's books to purchase on Amazon. Plenty of pictures and memorabilia. If you go to Instagram for Kirby, and if you reach out to Rich, there's plenty of footage that you can purchase and watch. So you can get your, between the three of them, whatever kind of media you like, you can get your Portland Wrestling fill.
Can I say one thing about the footage?
Yeah, yeah.
And YouTube. I've put a couple of things on YouTube. It's Music Guy 64, but not very much. So there are people out there who are posting this video that I saved and restored, claiming it as theirs. So just beware. Please know that, you know, if they want to post it, okay, fine. But the claiming it as their own, that's one thing that kind of gets to me. They're not the one that spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours working as a labor of love for this.
Yeah, and when it's posted on YouTube, you never know when it's going to be gone, right? And, you know, you won't be able to see it anymore. if you buy a, you know, the material, the drive from Rich, it's yours, right? And you got it.
These have many complete shows on
there
them.
There you
as
go.
Well. With yeah. Many of them have the original commercials. So Portland people will see the Tom Peterson commercials. They'll see the Marv Tonkin and Friendly Chevrolet commercials, things like that.
Yep. All integral, right? Every territory had those kind of things, had those sponsors, those commercials that were integral to the shows. So guys, I appreciate, again, I've done lots of group interviews like this. This has been the smoothest to put together a schedule. I mean, usually I got to go back and forth all the time trying to, this one came together so easy. Everybody was on time. What a dream. But again, in the future, you know, we might revisit with all or some of you and dive a little deeper into specific things of Portland, because it's a fascinating territory. One of the longest running territories, particularly televised, continual, television. And it's like we said, there's a lot of talent that's underappreciated and overlooked through Portland, or people have different perceptions than what they should have of the talent if they could see some of their Portland stuff. So, but again, I could talk for hours on this stuff. I love hearing the stories.
So can we.
I love talking. Yeah. I love hearing it. It's hard, my end of it, it's like, oh, we got to keep it reasonable because who's going to listen to a 6-hour podcast, about this stuff. I could, but I appreciate, I know you guys are all busy and have your projects, and I appreciate your time. And again, I urge everybody to go check out all your stuff if they want to explore Portland a little deeper. And I urge them to look at Portland a little deeper. It's a great territory. And again, one of the longest running. So guys, thank you. Everybody go follow them on the social media they mentioned. Go, buy the drive from Rich, buy the books from Mike, buy the all the merchandise and stuff from Kirby on the Big Cartel store. And
Kirby's coats are amazing. Those satin jackets, though, those are fantastic.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if any of us can, can pull it off quite like Kirby when he models it. He looks pretty. There you go. Yeah. I mean, Kirby.
Still got those.
If you check out Kirby's Instagram, right, he's there modeling it.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we can all pull it off like Kirby, but we can all try.
Oh, you guys got it. I know you do.
Well, buy a jacket and try.
Yeah.
Hey, you bums. We have to take a quick break.
Hey guys, Ray Russell here, curator of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, inviting you guys to listen to many of the programs here as part of the WrestleCopia brand, including, but not limited to, the Wrestling Memory Grenade, currently covering the 1988 and the WWF project. You can also listen to the Regional Wrestling Podcast, where we talk the territories, whether it's Jamie Ward with Georgia 81, Roman Gomez with the UWF in 1986, or Gene Jackson covering Memphis in 85. Three projects going on right now over there at Regional Wrestling. You can also listen to The Wrestling Stoop with the legend himself, Bob Roop. Bob goes back in time each and every week, covering not just his career, but countless stories and interactions with hundreds of wrestling names spanning his two decades in the business. But that's not all. You can also check out the Puro Wrestling Academy with the professor of Puro Resu, Mr. Dan Ginnity. Dan and I go back in time and cover the history of Japanese professional wrestling in the English language. And you can listen to all of those shows and more, all part of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, located over at WrestleCopia.com. That's WrestleCopia.com, and anywhere your podcast streaming needs are met, from Apple to Spotify, Pocket Cast, and beyond. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to our social media guys for all the latest goings on here at the WrestleCopia Podcast Network. Plus, I'm constantly adding old school video clips and pictures from throughout wrestling history. You can follow us over on X, formerly Twitter, at Wrestling Grenade. That's at R-A-S-S-L-I-N Grenade. Also, follow and like me, Facebook.com/Wrestling Grenade. And why not subscribe to YouTube.com/Wrestling Grenade. So if you're looking to support that next up-and-coming podcast brand, please consider making it WrestleCopia.
Hey, it's Bob Smith, and guess what? The Outdated Wrestling Hour is now part of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network. But hey, no fear, you're still going to hear the unique guests, comedy, music, authors, journalists, funny people. who knows who's going to end up on the Outdated Wrestling Hour. Remember, it's all new and all old. So check it out in the WrestleCopia Podcast Network and wherever you get your podcasts. Listen if you know what's good for you.
Hey everybody, Gene Jackson here, inviting you to check out the Retro Wrestling Review, where each week I'm joined by some great co-hosts who help me review classic episodes of USWA Championship Wrestling, and right now we are doing week-by-week reviews of 1993. But we don't just do reviews, sometimes we get a chance to interview some of the people who were there and lived it, plus do watch-alongs. It's a lot of fun, so check out new episodes that drop every Wednesday at WrestleCopia.com. And to find links to everything associated to the podcast, you can go to uswapodcast.com.
We're back on Wrestling Nostalgia.
All right. And thank you to Mike, Kirby, and Rich for joining me and talking Portland. So much fun. Super enjoyed that. And hopefully you guys did too. Hey, everybody. Besides following all those guys on social media and checking out their stuff, go follow me on social media. You can just look up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty or The Dave Dynasty, all one word, and you'll find me on pretty much any social media platform. Also, make sure you go check out all the other WrestleCopia of Network podcasts, whatever I'm trying to say there. Go check out all the other WrestleCopia podcasts. The shows are all fun. Got some great hosts, great topics, lots of good, fun, entertaining history talk. You can look them up on your favorite podcast platform or go to WrestleCopia.com. Also, be sure to check out my friends at the Ultimate Classic Wrestling Library. Go to ClassicWrestling.net or you can download the Ultimate Classic Wrestling app on all of your smart devices. Now, next episode. A while back, I announced that in future installments of the Stampede Wrestling Deep Dive from 1988, which, yes, we are going to do more of those here on Wrestling Nostalgia. But I did announce that on those future installments, I will have a co-host, Abu Wiesel, who was a manager at Stampede during that time, will join me on those Stampede Deep Dives. Well, next episode, Abu Wiesel joins me as a guest. We're going to introduce you to him and his career and talk all about it. We're going to talk Stampede Wrestling, the Hart Family, and much more. Kind of an intro 101, to Abu Wiesel. So he is going to be on next episode. Guys, thank you for joining me. Thank you for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed all that Portland Wrestling talk earlier. Some good stuff. It was super exciting to do. But until next episode, guys, wherever you go, whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we've brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Manager thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.
Wrestling Nostalgia is copyright Dave Dynasty, Bruiser voice done by John Lawson.